Good morning, everyone. The hour being 10:15, we're going to get started. The meeting will come to order. We do not yet have a quorum, so I'm going to dispense with the reading of the minutes, but I want to get on with things here. We have two items of business today. One is a overview of pensions by Mr. Larry Martin, and then after we've done that for maybe an hour, we'll get into dealing with House File 374. So members, welcome. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Martin. And I know that we'll have a lot of questions once you're done with your presentation, but please go ahead, Mr. Martin. Welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Larry Martin. I'm the Executive Director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. What I'm going to cover primarily until you have questions for me is the document that dated February 13th covering the contributions to public employee pension plans in the state of Minnesota. And I've looked at this from the three areas, or the three reasons why contributions would be made. First, where the state of Minnesota is the direct employer and makes the employer contributions to a public pension plan. And that's covered the greatest part of page one of the two-page memo. And then I've looked at the various direct pension-related state aid programs. That's the bottom of page one and the top of page two. And then talk a little bit about indirect state aids that have a pension aspect to them. So first I'll talk a little bit about where the state of Minnesota is the employer. I've identified 12 retirement plans and given you a sense of where that occurs. The largest of the plans is item number one, the general employees plan of the state retirement system. And that covers the bulk of state government. Also covers the University of Minnesota, non-faculty employees, and the Met Council. Additionally, there's the unclassified plan. This is the plan that legislators who are took office after 1997, and most legislative employees, some executive branch, upper agency directors, commissioners, and some judicial branch employees are also in the unclassified plan. The correctional state employees plan, which is primarily the Department of Corrections, and that portion of Health and Human or of Human Services that runs either the sex offender program or the St. Peter Hospital. The state patrol plan. This is primarily the public safety state troopers, but it also includes the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. It includes the natural resources game wardens. Includes the commerce and insurance investigators, and the fugitive apprehension officers for the corrections department. The judges' retirement plan. This is the all the various judges in the state of Minnesota. There's a remnant legislators plan, which has now been combined with the elected state officers, former constitutional officers plan. And this would be the pre-1997 members of the legislature and the retirees and various deferred members of the legislators plan, and the six constitutional officers, former constitutional officers that are receiving benefits from that plan. This one is, unlike the others, not funded on an actuarial basis, but is funded on a pay-as-you-go or current disbursements basis. We also have supported by the state of Minnesota with direct employer contributions with MinSCU, the individual retirement account plan, a defined contribution plan, and the college supplemental retirement plan, also a defined contribution plan. TRA, where there are faculty in the MinSCU system that have either prior K-12 teaching service or were in place when IRAP was created back in 1989, they're covered by a TRA. Similarly, the St. Paul Teachers Plan covers a small number of state employees, principally the St. Paul Tech and our community college faculty. PERA has a small handful of state employees, some from the Met Council, some from the judicial branch. When the judicial branch has acquired some former county employees, and for Minskew janitorial and those sorts of non-teaching personnel that may be in the tech colleges transferred from the old vocational technical schools. PERA Police and Fire, a small number, the Duluth, the Air Base Fire Department, the Met Council Transit Police, and the University of Minnesota Police are all covered by PERA Police and Fire. And then the University of Minnesota Faculty Plan, which is a defined contribution plan. So those are the places where the state makes our direct contributions. You jump to page 2 of the memo.
Excuse me, Mr. Martin. I'm going to interrupt you here if I can and declare I see that there is now a quorum, so the meeting is officially convened. We do have the minutes of the last meeting of February 9th before us. Are there any additions, corrections, changes to those minutes? Otherwise, does anyone make a motion to approve the minutes of the 9th? Representative Len Chesky moves approval of the meeting of the minutes of February 9th. Seeing no discussion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. And Mr. Martin, now coming back to you, before we go to the next page, Mr. Martin, I guess I just want to make sure I set the stage and make sure that everyone kind of understands what's in this first classification of numbers you've gone through. So, for example, I think about legislators, Mr. Martin, I think these days, well, I guess I don't know how the pre-1997 legislators who didn't opt for the new plan works, but if I remember right, I think that legislators like us here have 4% withheld from our salaries and the state matches 4%, and so the 4% that is matched is what is in this employer contribution here for like number 2. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, the member contribution to the unclassified plan is indexed to the same member contribution as the MSRS general plan, and that's 5.5%. And the employer contribution to the unclassified plan is 6%. And I'm looking at Mr. Bergstrom.
So I stand corrected.
So
I'm
the member
sorry,
contribution is 5.5, okay. And the state makes a 6% contribution on your behalf.
I obviously don't pay a great deal of attention to my own pension. But anyway, so that 6% is that the state is contributing is what is in this numbers, not anything that employees are contributing, correct?
Mr. Chair, this is where I've laid out a contribution amount. It is the employer contribution amount. For the legislators who are in office, started in office after 1997, or for those who had chosen to jump from the legislators' plan, which is a defined benefit plan, to the unclassified plan, the number you're looking at, you're folded into the numbers in item number 2, because you're in the unclassified plan.
Right.
So you're there along with legislative staff, staff of the State Board of Investment, the constitutional officers, staff, and the department heads and agency heads. The legislators plan on item number 6, this is strictly the pre-1997 plan for state legislators, and there's a 9% contribution by the employee, by the member, and there is not a regular payroll period to payroll period contribution by the state, by the employer, but there is appropriated as part of the State Department's bill the amount of money that's estimated to be payable in pension benefits to the various legislators and constitutional officers.
And Mr. Martin, if I look at numbers, say, 8, 9, 10, and 11, you said that a small portion of this is state as opposed to Minsky, for example, or the Duluth Fire Department. Do you have any rough estimate of what a small portion is for each of those? Are we talking 10%? Are we talking 30%? Do you know offhand?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't. If I had a decent estimate, I would have provided it. It really is a question of how many people and what size salaries compared to the total, and it's not the numbers I usually work with, and so I don't have a very good handle on it.
Yeah. Okay.
Your fiscal staff, I would be happy to sit down and try and help where I can. Your fiscal staff may have more of the raw information from whence a number could be generated.
And similarly with number 7, the Minsky plan, do you have any sense of a rough number of what that is?
Mr. Chair, because it's a defined contribution plan and we don't get regular actuarial work for it, I don't have any real current numbers. I have some numbers that are a few years old, but I decided that would be more problematic than just leaving it unavailable.
All right. Well, that's fine, Mr. Martin. I guess just want to bring to everyone's attention that if I add up the numbers that are available where the state pays the entire total, I come up with in 2014 the state contributed $208,800,000 to these plans. So I assume for a biennium it would be twice that anyway. We'd be at $417 million. That the state is contributing to its employees, plus whatever portion the state has that we don't have available to us. Does that sound right, Mr. Martin?
Mr. Chair, yes, that sounds roughly correct. Understand, this is the contributions to just the state-run pension programs. Most of our state employees are also covered by Social Security. If you're talking about the entirety of their retirement package, there's also a 7.6% of pay Social Security contribution.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Martin. Why don't you go to your next section, Section 2.
If you turn to page 2 of the memo, I've given you first a listing of the various direct state aid programs that are related to public pensions, and then follow it with some numbers as to the dollar amounts involved. I did it this way because I think it's easier to focus on when these state aid programs were created. They run a considerably long period of time from the fire state aid that was created in the late 1800s through the police and fire retirement supplemental aid program that was created by the 2013 legislature. There are some of these are no longer in place, as it were. The TRA state aid program that's listed here was in place from 1915 through 1967 in part. So some of these are old programs, but I've laid out them by the date that they were created. Most of these, a large number of these, would be appearing in the tax bill. It's in the jurisdiction of the tax committee. Those that are not, this would be the PERA employer state aid. No, I'm sorry, that's tax. Some of these are in the state government finance bill, so it falls into one of the two jurisdictions. And the state aid program amounts that I have for you are in the middle of the page. And I've given you, where possible, 3 years' worth of numbers so you get some feeling for the change. These are the numbers that, in the main, these are the numbers that were provided by Minnesota Management and Budget, with one exception, I believe, the 2013 Police and Fire Supplemental Aid. There's actually a typo there. That should be $15.5 million, not $15 million straight. And the MMB numbers, for whatever reason, carry that at 14.5 when the appropriation was 15.5. So this gives you a flavor of the dollar amounts of the direct aids. Some of these are made to the pension fund directly. Others are made to the employing unit and used to offset what would otherwise be the employer contribution raised from other sources. So the fire state aid, for instance, is the principal aid that goes to volunteer fire pension programs or fire pension contributions in those cities where we have paid full-time paid fire departments. The fire surcharge, the insurance surcharge, this occurs only in Minneapolis, Duluth, St. Paul, and Rochester. Dates back to the 1930s and is paid to the employer. Police state aid is paid directly to PERA. The MRF division aid is also paid directly to PERA. The local police and fire amortization aid is once covered 48 local police and fire relief associations. It's now down to just the city of Minneapolis and gets paid directly to PERA. The supplemental volunteer fire benefit reimbursement, this is paid to volunteer fire pension programs and offsets or is has to do with a special benefit that was directed to be paid by these volunteer fire plans from back in the 1980s, having something to do with a change in tax law related to the taxation of lump sum pension benefits. And in the towards the end there, the various teacher pension fund aids, Minneapolis teachers and Duluth teachers aids, are paid to TRA now that those two plans have consolidated with TRA. The St. Paul teacher aid that you see there is paid directly to the St. Paul teachers plan. And the newest of the aids, the 2013 police and fire supplemental aid, is paid $1 million of it goes to the state patrol, between five and six million goes to PRA police and fire, and the balance goes to the volunteer fire plans in the state.
All right, and let me interrupt you. I've got a question from Representative Kahn.
Yes, one of the issues that I've followed for quite a while is the issue of the volunteer firefighter investment plans, and there was, well, trying to clean out some old papers at home, I found the 2007 Legislative Auditor's Report, which said that one of the things that should happen is that the volunteer fire plans should all be using the State Board of Investment for their investment practices. And I think and one of the issues about pension plans is that we keep concentrating kind of on the money that we're putting into it, but I think the financial health of a pension plan is two-thirds depend on investment and one-third dependent on contributions. And so it's the investment plan is very much more important than the than that. And so what's happening? I know I tried to make it compulsory for them all to be invested by the State Board of Investment, unless they could prove that they had a better investment portfolio. But I think the compromise was to make it voluntary. What's happened with that?
Mr. Martin.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Kahn, my memory, I haven't looked at this real recently, but something like 80% of the volunteer fire plans do utilize the State Board of Investment to some degree. It's not necessarily real common to have 100% of their assets with the State Board of Investment, but it's a majority, and I think 80% have some of their assets invested with the State Board of Investment. Also, if you remember, in 2007, I believe, there was the creation of the statewide volunteer right. fire retirement program, which now has in excess of 100 volunteer fire departments in it. This is out of a total of 720-30 volunteer fire departments, so a pretty fair number. And in that case, for those 100 plus volunteer fire departments, 100% of the assets of their pension plan are invested by the State Board of Investment. So the use of the statewide plan is growing. There has been long-standing authority for the volunteer fire departments to utilize the State Board of Investment, and a majority of them utilize the State Board to some degree.
I think
Representative
Kahn. One of the things we thought was just getting the information out would be more helpful in doing this. Do we have report? Do we have a report each year on the investment performance of these? Of these funds, does that come from the auditor, or
yes,
where does
Mr.
that
Chairman,
come
from? Yes, the state auditor's shop does produce a report that has the financial information about the various volunteer fire plans, and towards the end of that document also lays out the investment performance of all of the 700 or thereabouts volunteer fire pension programs.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I assume that you probably have paid more attention to that than I have, at least I hope. Could you possibly give us some summary of the last results of that, or you know, or just if you could isolate that and just send it
by to send it
by email?
Because, certainly.
You know, again, I think this is we're conscious about how our local governments are performing and how it's affecting the financial picture of the state. This is something that we all ought to be taking them up on. Do they have a volunteer fire department that has an inferior pension, inferior investment performance, and why aren't they investing using the state investment board to do their investments?
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Yes, if you could get that,
yes,
that
Mr.
would be
Chairman.
Good. And I guess, Mr. Martin, let me ask you, following up to Representative Kahn, so if a volunteer fire organization chooses to use, I don't know, their own investment manager, and they fall short of the state's performance, have we had situations where they've come to the state and then gotten relief from the state in terms of a contribution to make their plan whole?
Mr. Chairman, no. Not that they've successfully done that. I can only recall one occasion where a municipality has pursued getting a special aid amount from the state of Minnesota back about 15 years ago, and that was not viewed favorably by the pension commission and did not occur.
So, Mr. Martin, you're saying none of the fire state aid that's like on the top line indirectly goes to any situations like that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the fire state aid is used to support the various volunteer fire pension programs, whether they're doing well or not doing well. It does not change in amount based on their investment performance. The fire state aid is really a distribution of where it's based on the tax
sure.
on in investment or on insurance premiums for fire and related insurance. It's allocated principally based on the relative size of the population served by the fire department and the relative property value of the area served by the fire department. Mm-hmm. One half of the aid is allocated in each manner. So a given volunteer fire pension program will get roughly the same amount of money year after year after year unless its property value changes greatly or its population changes greatly. And it's irrespective of what benefit they're providing and whether they've done well or not done well investing that money previously.
All right. And Mr. Martin, I guess as I'm looking at these numbers, I added up 2012 and 2013. It came up to be about $287 million of state support that biennium. Would you expect that 2015 support was about the same as 2014 that you show on your report?
Mr. Chair, yes. A lot of these aids do not change in their dollar amount. The ones that the two that might are the two of the larger, the fire state aid and the police state aid, because those are derived from insurance premium taxes. And if more or less insurance is written either for auto casualty or for fire, those could bounce a bit and do bounce periodically. But I would assume they're going to be roughly in the same ballpark.
Okay, so then I guess as I add up 2014, I come up with about $192 million. So if we just doubled that, we'd have about $384 million in these other aids that would be on this page, plus the 400-some million we identified on the other page. So I guess, would you say it's fair that the state spends over $800 million of biennium on pensions?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that sounds like a reasonable estimate.
All right, thank you. And Mr. Martin, can you talk a little bit about, I know that in some cases the state has sort of made arrangements to take over some of these funds that were in deficiency. I think there was a deal with the Duluth Teachers Fund, for example, in the last few years. In other cases, they're standalone funds that there isn't any kind of an arrangement with. Can you identify on here which ones have sort of had deals or understandings made and which ones haven't?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think you're talking about the consolidations of public pension plans. The state has had the state, for better or for worse, is the state with the second largest number of public employee pension plans. Only the state of Pennsylvania has more. We, in our heyday, had close to 900. We've whittled that number back some, so it's in the mid 700s probably. Now, Pennsylvania has 3,500 or more public employee pension plans. We've succeeded in consolidating all of the police and paid fire pension plans that were local plans. So hence, up in your area, the St. Cloud Police and Fire consolidated sometime in the early 1990s with PERA. And then all of those plans have been merged into PERA Police and Fire back in 1999. Two of the three teacher plans, local teacher plans, have now consolidated with the statewide TRA, Minneapolis Teachers in 2006 and Duluth Teachers in 2014. MRF, the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Plan, has first consolidated administratively with PERA back in 2010, and by operation of law, now that it has reached 80% funded, has now fully merged with PERA General Plan. So those would be some of the instances where we've consolidated local plans. Sometimes there has been state money paid prior to the consolidation, as was the case with the local police and paid fire plans. Those plans were not funded on an actuarial basis until 1969, and when that requirement in law came into place, the shift from pure pay-as-you-go to starting to pay full actuarial requirements didn't occur until 1980. So there was a long stretch where they were phasing in the greater contributions. When the state required those plans to start phasing out and they had to actually amortize, there was some state money that was added for those plans, the amortization aid programs, which paid the difference between the full amortization contribution and interest only for those plans, as a way to avoid having a state mandate, an unfunded state mandate for those localities. So the state has done some funding for the various local police and paid fire plans. We've also done some extra funding for both MRF, Minneapolis Teachers, and Duluth Teachers over the past decade. There are other consolidations where there was no state money involved. For instance, the former bus company pension plan that the MTC acquired or inherited was merged into the state retirement system back in 1978 with no extra state money involved there. The University of Minnesota Police Pension Plan, also in 1978, was merged into PERA Police and Fire. The St. Paul Bureau of Health was merged. That local plan was merged into PERA back in 1969 without any extra state money involved. So the consolidations occur or don't occur with or without state money, depending upon what shape the pension plan is in, what motivated the consolidation, and what resources there were locally to fund other remaining pension liabilities.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martin, that I appreciate your kind of historical perspective on where we have come from to get us to this point. I'm just wondering if you can extrapolate. A lot of the pension plans' funding obligation is representative of the demographics that the plan serves in terms of the aging, in terms of the contribution. I'm just wondering if you could share for us in terms of expectations, in terms of how that funding obligation will grow as the participants in the plans age as well. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, I'm not sure that, the way we try and fund these plans, we're looking for a level payment as a percentage of covered pay for these plans to the extent possible. That's the mathematical goal. And so it's supposed to be a relatively stable amount and wouldn't necessarily move to any great extent with the aging of the populations. As the retirees age, and to the extent that they exceed the expected mortality dates, yes, we can expect to have greater contributions by virtue of that. Built into the system, however, is an increasing dollar amount over time. We're amortizing these plans as a percentage of payroll, and it's a level percentage of an expected increasing payroll. And so by design, we're each year until the amortization target date, we're expecting greater and greater dollar amounts to go into these plans. So it's intended to keep things at a level percentage of payroll, but because payroll is expected to increase, it will be an increasing dollar amount, and that's just the mathematics of the design of the funding of the pension plan.
Mr. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Martin, then, how would you describe for the committee the current funding ratio itself?
Mr. Martin.
Members, I think you have in your packets some information from me. Mr. Stone, are these the two-year numbers or the one-year numbers? Two-year?
Stone.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Martin, it's the one-year numbers.
Okay. Members, you've got a summary of actuarial valuation results. This is the most recent. These relate to the defined benefit plans that are in the state of Minnesota. And the first page of the document gives you summaries by groupings of plans. And if you run all the way over to the far right-hand side of the page, we have a total for all plans. And the funding ratio is a little over 77%. Assets of actuarial value of assets, just over $55 billion against accrued liabilities of just under $72
billion. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martin, I want to kind of separate the two concepts in a pension, maybe for the sake of a comment that Representative Kahn made. It's true that we have both a funding liability and a performance aggregate on a yearly basis that goes against offsetting the liability that we are accruing on an annual basis towards the participants of all these pension plans. And so as it would pertain to just the funding responsibility, if the market has done so well in, say, the last 2 or 3 years, why is it that we have an unfunded liability of $16.5 billion?
Mr. Martin?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Albright, we inherited some of that unfunded from before 2008. 2008, of course, was the Great Recession. And there was a 25-30% drop in assets in 1 year by virtue of that. We have a although we've had good returns for all but, I think, 1 year since the 2008 recession has been over, we're talking, we're climbing back to where we were before the 2008 recession. So it's a combination of factors. We also have had actuarial assumption changes. Mortality assumptions have been strengthened. The interest rate assumption was reduced. There was a clarification or a redo on the post-retirement adjustment actuarial assumption, which also caused a recognition of greater unfunded pension liabilities. And then I was explaining briefly the level percentage of pay amortization process, which by its nature doesn't pay off the full unfunded the same way you might pay off a house mortgage level dollar. During the first half or so of the amortization period, the unfunded actually goes up. So by mathematical design, the unfundeds of some of these plans or all these plans increases.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Martin, in light of the actuarial assumptions that, is it my understanding that the actuarial assumption for performance is 8.5% or 8%?
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's 8% for the 5-year period through 2017, and then it returns to 8.5%.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martin, in light of the performance of 2014, 2013, a little blip in years prior to that, pension plans by their very nature are a conservative means by which that participants will realize hopefully a good percentage of what is promised to them. And my a couple questions is, in light of the 8% or 8.5% that, you know, we are establishing as the benchmark for performance within these pension plans, how would that compare to other states? And then also, if you're willing, I'm wondering how that would compare to the private markets, where conceivably you have large Fortune 100 companies with pension plans who are arguably of the same size or larger in terms of asset base.
Mr. Martin.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative, the numbers that I've seen for other states, the principal comparison is of the larger pension plans, and Minnesota is definitely in the minority. We're on the optimistic side of the comparative interest rate assumptions used by the statewide plans or major local plans in the 50 states. There are only a few other jurisdictions that have 8.5 or thereabouts as part of their actuarial assumption. With corporate plans, we're also higher than what would be typically expected for a corporate plan. I'm not sure that the size of the investment portfolio is as much a determiner as the federal legislation that relates to when they amortize their unfunded liabilities and how they do their actuarial work and their plan benefit guarantee corporation obligations for plan termination insurance. But we are also higher than would be typical to be found in a private sector plan.
Okay. Representative Albright, in the interest of being fair to everyone else, I'm going to give you one more question, and I'm going to move on to Representative Hamilton and Kahn. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martin, in just for comparative sake, what would be your assessment of the unfunded liability for the on the largest plan if we dropped the assumed rate of return back to something akin to 7.25% or 7.5% as opposed to where it is now? What would that do to our unfunded liability?
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, I it would just be an abstract guess on my part. I've seen some numbers for a 7.8% assumption, I believe. But at the moment, unless Mr. Bergstrom happens to remember what they were, I remember seeing them. I could clearly find them for you, but I can't give it to you off the top of my head, and I don't have a rule of thumb, easy way of trying to estimate. If you drop the interest rate assumption, you will significantly impact on the unfunded. You will significantly drive up the recognition of actuarial liabilities, but I can't tell you with any certainty how that would go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Martin, if you've already said this in the essence of time, just say so, and I'll go back and review the tapes. But on the second page under the direct state aid programs related to public pensions and when they were created, the Teacher Retirement Association, it looks like it was created in 1915. And then if you scroll down a little bit further, you have the Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Fund and the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund established in 1993. Can you help me understand the reasoning behind the separation there, and how has that benefited all teachers across the state, if you would, please?
Mr. Martin.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, we've had four teacher pension plans in the state of Minnesota historically. Three of them, the first class city teacher plans, were created by a 1909 law, were actually implemented in 1910. TRA did not, the predecessor to TRA was not created until 1915 and applied to every teacher who was not otherwise in one of the first class city teacher. That 1915 law teachers plan defaulted during the Great Depression. All retirees had their benefits cut in half. They were not restored until 1957. The state really didn't start contributing to any great extent in funding the TRA plan on an actuarial basis until the 1967 session of the legislature when the sales tax was first imposed. And it was part of the funding destinations for some of the money raised by the sales tax during that session. At the same time, the first class city teachers got a proportional share of that sales tax proceeds, and that was the start of the actuarial funding to a greater extent of those three plans. So if I've given you the impression that we once had a single plan and the plans were split up to create four, that's not exactly how it happened. There was no teacher pension coverage before 1909 for anyone. There was a Carnegie report back in the early 1900s that suggested that college professors and other teachers have pension coverage that would improve the teaching profession. And shortly thereafter, we created first the first class city teacher plans and then the predecessor to TRA.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Martin, do you see, would there be any benefit to merge all those teacher plans into one?
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, two out of the three local plans have consolidated with TRA. Minneapolis Teachers in 2006 and Duluth in 2014. St. Paul Teachers has looked at whether they're interested in consolidating, and their answer that came back was no, they're not.
Representative Kahn.
Well, I know we've gone back and forth on this issue, but the numbers that show the $55 billion in assets is based on actuarial numbers. And there's the argument of should we use actuarial numbers or market value numbers. And if we use the market value numbers, I think the number is much higher, and the funding ratio then becomes 10% higher. And so, do you know what the market value of the assets are, or do the fund directors know? And let me, while I'm thinking about it, when I first started looking at this, I believed that everything should be merged into one plan. One of the things that the St. Paul, and, you know, as we've seen some of the plans not operate very well and need more help, then that becomes a stronger argument. One of the separate arguments about having separate plans is that you get to make comparisons, and I think the St. Paul Teachers plan investment portfolio has consistently been better than the others. I'm not sure. You know, anything I say could be 2 years out of date or more or something like that. But, you know, I said just the fact that it was kind of nice to be able to have different things to compare, I started going away from that. But the worst one, the worst ones are the non-consolidated volunteer fire plans, particularly. But the one time I was really going to go after that was the year that the state market went, the stock market went belly up, and the pension plans, volunteer plans that were invested in cash in their local banks looked like investment geniuses. So I pulled off that one. But I'd like to know about, should we be using market value or actuarial value, and what?
Mr. Martin, can you respond to that question, and then maybe give us a rough idea of how much higher the funding would be if we used the market value?
Mr. Chair, yes, I can. The numbers that you have on this page are the actuarial value of assets. The actuarial value of assets dates back to around the year 2000, and it's a five-year average, smoothing average. It's not exactly the five annual amounts divided by five, but it is a five-year smoothing procedure, somewhat complicated formula, but it does smooth out the highs and lows to try and take out some of the volatility. Obviously, what it does in a down market is it creates a recognized value that's higher potentially than the market value. In an up market, it does the opposite. We're in an up market at the moment. Market value of assets, when I've looked at the various, most of our plans, is in the neighborhood of about 11% higher than the current actuarial value of assets figure. And if you increase the asset value, you're going to have more than 11% swing on the or impact on the funding ratio. The actuarial value of assets was an improvement over the prior way we calculated assets for pension purposes, which was cost value of assets plus one-third of the difference between market and cost. That didn't seem to make a lot of sense, notwithstanding it. Well, that had been created in 1984. So the actuarial value of assets was a better recognition of the current state of affairs than the prior version. But I personally don't think it's a particularly valuable way to do things, to have two sets of books, and that's what we in effect are doing currently. The actuarial valuations do disclose the market value of assets as well as the actuarial value of assets. Some of the key triggers for funding purposes right now in state law are triggered by market value of assets, not actuarial value of assets. And I don't think having two sets of values does us any particular good. And my recommendation to the commission has been to go to a market value of assets and live with the swings. Thus far, the commission has not pursued that.
Thank you. All right. Well, Mr. Martin, why don't you finish off with the rest of your presentation? I know you have a third part you wanted to talk about.
Members, that's going to be the shortest and the least clear as far as dollar amounts. This is the indirect aids. The once upon a time, TRA had a set of particular or categorical aids that were related to our retirement coverage. This would have been back before about 1987. Those were consolidated into the General Education Aid Program in the late 80s and no longer a separate aid program. So one of the indirect aids that we have would be the General School Aids Program, which school districts can use to offset their retirement obligations, as well as they can use it for other expenditure purposes. Similarly, the local government aid program can be used for retirement purposes by a given municipality, but there's no way to pinpoint what portion of either of those two aids would be particularly for retirement, but they are a source of revenue for the governmental subdivisions that can be used for retirement purposes. So just stating the obvious, perhaps, but they're there too.
All right, Representative Cornish.
Well, Mr. Martin, would it be safe to say, I sat through the Senate hearings last year on the pensions, and I sat through this today. Would it be safe to take away from this meeting that the pensions in Minnesota are not that bad a shape and that we are doing well nationally? And that part of the reason it is because of the millions of dollars that the employees have put in to fix it through reduction in COLAs or benefits and trying to help the fund out?
Mr. Martin?
Mr. Chairman, I would agree that our plans are in reasonable shape. The fact that we keep monitoring them and that we keep adjusting contribution rates when there are problems, and also adjusting benefit rates as we or benefit obligations as was done by the legislature over the period 2010 through 2013 help. So I think we are comparatively in reasonable shape.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Martin, do you have any type of handle or figure on how much the employees actually put into the program to help fix it? How many in the millions in the last fix?
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Martin.
Yes, Mr. Chair. In that same page that we were looking at previously for the funding ratio, there, if you go down a little bit, there is a bottom line numbers for member contributions and employer contributions. You take the total all plans number. The employee contributions are just shy of a $1 billion, $989+ million.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. All right. Seeing no further questions for Mr. Martin, thank you very much for coming before the committee. We could have many, many hearings on this. It's a big issue. There's a lot of money here, but I felt like we needed to have a little bit of a overview for this committee, given the amount of money that's involved. And with that, I'll move on to the next agenda item, which is House File 374. Representative Sanders, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. The chair will move that House File 374 be referred to the General Register. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to be in front of the committee today. House File 374 is a bill that the Allied Charities have asked me to carry, and I'm honored to help carry this bill. It's a series of tweaks and modifications to their ability to operate in the state of Minnesota. As we all know, the charities and the benefits that the Allied Charities and Charitable Gaming's initiatives provide for the state are tremendous. Whether it be the youth hockey associations or volunteer fire departments, the legions, really a tremendous amount of good and resources go to these organizations on through charitable gaming. So this is a series of tweaks and modifications for that. The main purpose why we are here today is one of the last sections of the bill, which suspends the lottery's contracts with a couple vendors who we believe have those contracts have led the lottery to operate outside of their statutory authority. And so we are suspending those contracts until they can come to the legislature and ask for permission and go through the proper channels to make sure that they're operating the way that they should be. For all of you that were here the last biennium, this language before you was agreed to in conference committee, and the conference committee report was voted on 126-2. So there is nothing new in this bill. This is the same and identical language, and would ask for your support today, and I can stand for any questions.
All right. Members, we try to avoid taking a lot of testimony in this committee, but I know that we are obligated to ask for testimony and take it underneath House rules that passed last week. I've got a couple of members that have questions, and then I know that we've got a couple people, or at least one I know of, that wanted to testify. But let me first go to Representative Kahn, then Hamilton. Representative Kahn.
You know, one of the problems I have with this bill is that you have competing gambling entities, and I really don't like any of them, but you have competing gambling entities, and this is the Allied Charities bill, and Allied Charities says their returns are being diminished because of this new use of the this new ability to play the lottery. Well, one of the things I would like us to look at, and I don't know that we need to have the author do this now, is that the various return to public, the percent of the return to public purposes from both the lottery and from the pull-off. And the other issue, which has also been of interest to me, is that we've consistently worried about compulsive gambling. And I believe only the lottery makes contributions to compulsive gambling. So if we're stopping the ability of the lottery to raise more money, maybe we should cut out those contributions or spread them across the gambling field more thoroughly, particularly since it seems from the data that we've seen is that the lottery, players of the lottery are the least likely to be affected by compulsive gambling issues, that the other players are far more likely to call the hotline for help and so forth. So I think we should make the contribution to that, you know, relate more definitely to the lead. And the other problem I have with doing this is the fact that we're interfering with contracts that have been existed. And apparently, again, I know next to nothing about this, so I can just put it in the much more knowledgeable author of the bill. But what's the cost of the breaking of those contracts? I mean, wouldn't a more reasonable route be to stop expansion and not interfere with contracts that have already been entered into, that somebody's going to have to, I have no idea who's going to have to pay, but I can't imagine that we won't get into a suit saying that the state was the one who caused these contracts to be broken. But have you thought about those issues of the breaking, and the reason why it was fairly slow in terms of people going into it is that the vendors were very cautious about the amount of money that they had to put in to make this kind of pay at the pump or whatever
Representative Representative Sanders, why don't you respond to Representative Kahn's question about the contracts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kahn, yes. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about that, about what is reasonable and how should we best approach this. And I have two answers to that. One is, for me, this is about separation of powers. This is about the legislature standing up for its constitutional and statutory authority and the executive branch going beyond that authority. And so while it is very reasonable to say, yes, no more expansion unless you come to the legislature, the problem is if we do that, we're ceding our authority up front, saying that, okay, we understand. In fact, I think in a sense, I mean, to me, to my ears, the lottery kind of admits and says, look, going forward, we agree. We need to come to the legislature. But they didn't do that here. They didn't do that on these contracts. They decided, in consultation with their attorneys, with their vendors, that this was appropriate action to take. However, they did not consult with the legislature. The legislature has never contemplated what the relationship should be between the lottery and the internet, the lottery and being online. And that is something that I think the legislature should be contemplating. And so while, yes, it sounds very reasonable, I think that compromise is too strong for us because it gets down to our constitutional responsibilities. And so while I think, and I told the governor this when I met with him, sure, we could, the bill could stop right now if the lottery decided, okay, we're going to, on our own, stop what we're doing and come to the legislature and ask for permission to do these online games. That, in my opinion, is something reasonable and something that we could take a look at. But up front, I think that if we, I think it kind of cuts to our core principles if we say the lottery can just from now on come to the legislature for everything. But on these issues, we're okay just letting you do what you're doing. I think for me, it's more of a principle to that. Now, as far as the costs go, you know, it's interesting. The last couple fiscal notes, the costs have gone costs, in quotation marks, have gone down for the state, or if those contracts were to be broken. And I think it's very interesting when you look at the current situation of the games and the contracts that we're in. On the fiscal note, we have Play at the Pump and ATM sales are currently pilot programs and are scheduled for expansion. Currently, 54 Play at the Pump locations and 135 ATM locations. This fiscal note in the cost assumes that that number is increasing to over 500 locations. And so the point is, to the lottery, stop and come to the legislature. And I think that these fiscal notes are kind of, you know, the cost, if you really dig down, it's due to the expansion already of their current pilot programs from, again, 54 locations to over 500 locations. I think that if we can agree that without that expansion, those costs would be even lower. And also number five, on the, page seven, sales of electronic instant tickets are assumed to be $700,000 because that's the in conformance with November budget forecast. In other words, that's what we're budgeting for. Not that those are actual costs or actually where the lottery is at, but again, mostly projections. So, you know, I think those are probably my thoughts on those two issues of, you know, if the state needs to cover, and I think we can have conversations about if those contracts are broken, what those actual costs would be, should the lottery have entered into those contracts in the first place, and, you know, taking a look at the lottery's budget. You know, if the lottery should not have entered into these contracts without coming to the legislature, maybe they should pay for some of this. Maybe they should take some of their $9.3 million a year that they use on marketing and advertising to pay for some of these costs when they shouldn't have entered into these contracts in the first place.
All right. I think, Representative Kahn, and members, I think since this issue of contracts is before us, and I know we have some people that want to testify on it, perhaps it would make sense to take that testimony and then follow up afterwards. I know that I've got Mr. Brian Rice that wanted to testify, I believe, on that issue, if Mr. Rice would come forward. Mr. Rice, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me the opportunity to testify. My name is Brian Rice. I'm a lawyer in Minneapolis, and I'm here today representing Link 3. Link 3 is a software development startup firm that developed the Play at the Pump technology. In 2010, Link 3 entered into an agreement with the Minnesota State Lottery to develop a product to modernize the lottery and make it more convenient to a wider group of people to potentially play lottery at gas station pumps and ATM machines. The idea was to bring the product to where people are. An article in the National Convenience Store Association magazine in November 2012 stated 3 out of 4 people who go to convenience stores do not go into the store. Lotteries throughout the country have also seen dramatic drop in play with a key demographic group, particularly those aged 25 to 40. And the lottery studies show that Play at the Pump actually helps drive inside store sales as interest in the lottery is increased. This bill has had 2 prior hearings in the House, and I do appreciate the time you're giving me this morning, Mr. Chair. And I think Representative Kahn's raised some of the issues, and I think Representative Sanders is addressing these. But if I can break it down just quickly, there were essentially 4 arguments in favor of this legislation. First, that there is a problem with the technology that's being used, the Play at the Pump technology. Second, that Play at the Pump was offered only to certain individual retailers. Third, that Play at the Pump and lotteries online games are addictive and lead to compulsive gambling and therefore should be restricted. And the last argument, and I think perhaps the most important one for this committee and the legislature, is whether the lottery lacks legal authority to engage in this type and method of delivery of gambling, and therefore, if they do or they don't, there's this impairment of contract issue. Quickly on the technology issue, this technology that's been running in the state since 2013 has had no complaints. It is true in 2012 when it was first rolled out, with a different provider, or at least a different technology element, Verifone, it did have some glitches, but they were immediately corrected. And today, over 60 stations in Minnesota, mostly in greater Minnesota, are using this technology. And contrary to testimony in other committees, the process takes 20 to 30 seconds. It's basically like deciding you want a car wash at the pump in addition to gas. You can't do individual picks. It's just simply Mega Millions, Powerball, quick picks. There's no individual entry. The system is safe. You have to verify your age with a driver's license or state valid ID, and you can only use it with a debit card. The market research on this shows that people who own cars and have debit cards are people with more rather than less disposable income, and it's a area where the lottery is trying to strengthen its programs. Any winnings at play at the pump on a debit card go directly into your account if it's less than $600. So it's very secure. If it's over, like any other one else, that amount, you have to present yourself for payment. Just to be clear on this technology, it's now currently being used in three other states. And it was really developed in this state, and our company is grateful to the lottery and the state for giving us the opportunity. But it's online in Missouri, California, and North Dakota. Our company has spent over $8 million in developing this product in this state. And CPS Magazine, a national convenience store publication named Play at the Pump as the best new product of the year in 2014 for retail establishments. So we think the technology works, basically. One other argument for the need for this bill, that somehow we were preferring one group of retailers over another, that's simply not true. The product's available to any retailer in the state whose pumps have a technology that can be compatible with the system. And many of these retailers are going to have to upgrade their pumps. If we all look at it now, credit card fraud. New credit cards now have a chip implanted in it. Those chips are needed to do this interface, and it's going to be needed more and more at credit cards, at any paying at a pump or a credit card passage at any retail store. Representative Kahn talked about this addiction argument. I think it's been well established. We've heard a number of testimonies, committees, that lottery is certainly the least addictive form of gambling, particularly since you have two set weekly drawings. It's not the immediate loop and feedback where you're at a machine, a slot machine, or pull tabs and pulling, think you're going to get an immediate result. And certainly I would say that to say somebody's going to addicted to gambling by having to buy gas, which you do at Play at the Pump, and buy a lottery ticket, it would be a pretty unique addiction to have those two things factored in. And just quickly, the lottery has a $50 a week limit on players who purchase lottery tickets through Play at the Pump or its website. So it's a built-in feature to prevent excessive gaming. Less than 1% of people currently hit this $50 a week limit. And it's if someone's looking for a measure to limit compulsive gambling, you may want to consider extending that $50 a week or $50 a day to casinos or pull tab operations. That would probably do more to reduce compulsive gambling if that's really the purpose of the bill.
Okay.
And let me get to the main point, Mr. Chair, on the authority issue. The state's constitution explicitly authorized just two particular types of gambling, a state-sponsored lottery and on-track paramutual betting on horse racing. The constitution has no explicit authorization for charitable gambling or tribal gaming. In 1988, the Minnesotans voted to create an exception to the constitution's original prohibition against lottery or sales of lottery tickets by allowing the lottery to be operated by the state itself. And although opposed by many groups at the time, the lottery amendment did pass by a considerable margin. Subsequent legislation that created the state lottery granted significant authority to the state lottery director to conduct lottery operations. Until this legislation, I'm not aware there's ever been significant concerns raised with the lottery's method of operations. I understand that many legislators at the time the amendment passed, and still today, have great reservations about state-sponsored gambling. And many of you oppose it for a number of strongly held reasons. Yes, I would say that the lottery has been running away in a manner that's consistent with the state's value, in a manner consistent with the voters' desires. I might add that two times subsequently in 90 and 98, Minnesotans again voted first to dedicate 40% of these lottery proceeds to the Environmental Trust Fund, and then in 98 to extend that dedication to 2025. So be a rare issue where you've seen voters weigh in three times on the on how to run a program and where the money should go in our Constitution. Now, getting down with respect to...
Mr. Rice, you just about done?
Yes, yes,
okay.
I'll wrap it up. With respect to the argument the lottery has exceeded its authority, there's a significant difference of opinion. The lottery director in Link 3 looked at these the legislation in 2010 and again in 2012 when the contracts were entered into. Neither side found an impediment in the statute. And I guess what I'd call your attention to, part of this, if members look at top of page 13 in the bill, when it comes, there's two sections dealing with the lottery, 25 and 26. Section 25 deals with restrictions on the lottery, and this was written into the original legislation. Number one, it says the lottery can't engage in sports betting on 13.2. On 13.5, existing law says lottery can't be used basically for coin-operated slot machines. And three, it says lotteries can't do poll taps. This legislation is adding a fourth limitation on the lottery that says it can't do casino-style electric games. And the lottery hasn't tried to do that and has testified they wouldn't try to do it. So we're really getting down to what does this legislation do? The argument is the lottery didn't have authority to enter in these contracts. Yet the only thing this legislation is doing is suspending, and I would say impairing, this contract in violation of Article 1, Section 11 of the state constitution, which says you cannot, legislature can't pass a law impairing a contract. There's no legislation in this bill that says the lottery can't have internet gaming, the lottery can't have public terminals. It's simply saying, what Section 26 of this bill simply says, is the lottery director shall suspend the sale of lottery tickets through these devices and including the contracts with it. And as a matter of policy, we're just asking the legislature to look very carefully at what the law is. We think there it was authority in existing law. And what, in essence, this bill is going to do is simply impair the contract the lottery has with Link 3 and another contract with it has with another provider. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Sanders, maybe you can answer this question, or maybe it's a staff could. I was contacted by an individual from the small community that I live in. They're concerned about the cap. They do some good work about the monies that are raised for local community initiatives. One, can you share with us what that cap is? And two, is there any discussion as far as increasing that cap so they can continue doing good work around the community?
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'm sorry, I don't quite follow. Could you restate your question or preface it just a slightly different way?
Thank you, Mr.
Sorry,
Chairman.
I don't quite understand what you're saying.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Sanders, the way I understand it, for the local charity based on some of the gambling initiatives, I believe there's a $50,000 cap, I think is what they brought to my attention, and they were wondering if that cap could be raised a little bit so they could continue raising some additional dollars for the local community. Are you familiar with that?
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Yes, I am, but I'd like Mr. Lone, he's a little more authoritative on it. He runs ELI Charities.
Mr. Lund, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Alan Lund, Allied Charities Executive Director. Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, I think that your charity might be talking about a cap on deposits on electronic funds that is actually not in this bill, that's in the Gambling Control Board bill, that we're in discussions with them on raising that, because their bill would make it $1,000 and then they would need to get that money into the bank. And we're saying in our bill it's at $2,000. So I believe that's what they're referring to.
Okay. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a couple questions for the author. First of all, as far as the contract goes, I'm looking at statutes, section 16C.06, subdivision 3B, where basically it says that the lottery can't enter into a contract longer than 2 years. How long are these contracts that they have entered into?
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Davids, I believe testimony in the last committee was with amendments. They were going into about the fifth year of their contract. I believe they originally signed these in 2010.
Representative Davids.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And members, all we're hearing about, first of all, my comments are more towards Section 25 and 26. I'm fully supportive of the issues for the allied charities. But when it comes to Section 25 and 26, we really get off track when we discuss this because we're talking about how great the lottery is, how much it does for different entities, the environment, the general fund, whatever it might be. We talk about how good it is for puppies and kittens and things like that. But we're kind of missing the whole point. The whole point is the lottery is acting outside their constitutional and their statutory authority. And I've got several examples here where that's the case. For example, they can't become a lottery retailer, which they're doing by their online games, for example. And so if folks would like to discuss that further, I've got a whole list of where I believe that the lottery is operating outside of their constitutional authority or their statutory authority. We have to remember, members, that the constitutional amendment was passed in 1988. That was before Al Gore had invented the internet. Therefore, there are no nothing authorizing internet games as far as the lottery goes. I'd also point out, members, that this bill as is was passed 126-2. Nothing has changed. They're still operating outside of their authority. As far as lawsuits, I think there's probably it'd be safe to say there's going to be lawsuits either way here before this gets figured out. They're acting outside their authority. It's the lottery gone wild. We have to bring them back in to their statutory authority. We have to bring them back into their constitutional authority. And, you know, they're coming here asking for forgiveness. I think they should come here and ask for permission. They do not have permission to do what they're doing. It's very clear. They say, well, some attorney somewhere said it was okay. And by that theory, they're saying that since it's not prohibited, we can do whatever we want. Think about that in the Ag Committee. Think about that in the Education Committee. Think about that in any committee. If that's the way we're going to interpret a law, Katie, bar the door. And we've got some huge problems if that's the logic that we're going to use. So I support this bill fully. I want to thank Representative Sanders for bringing this. It helps the Allied Charities. It brings the lottery back where they need to be. So I hope we can give it a positive vote.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is a bill that is moving very quickly, full steam ahead. And Representative Sanders, I know you kind of referred to the fact that you'd had a conversation with the governor, but we all know that he did veto this bill, I think 1 year ago about that, in the last session anyway. So the governor obviously has strong feelings about it. So I kind of thought that the new GOP majority was going to be was going to work with the administration, and I think that I'm wondering whether this is just a very confrontational kind of thing that we're doing here today, notwithstanding that I supported your bill last time and probably will again. But, you know, where is the compromise here? Have you had discussions with the governor and tried to find some compromise with him? I'd like to hear a little bit more about that because I thought that we weren't going to be in confrontational mode, and this seems pretty confrontational to me.
Chair Sanders.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Liebling. Certainly, it's not designed to be confrontational. I will say if it was a good idea last year, if it was right for the legislature to stand up for its authority last year, it should be again this year. For me, again, this is something that is very important and goes back to a constitutional separation of powers issue. The Constitution, the amendment in 1988, established the lottery through the legislature. And so we created it, we should control it, and we should regulate it. The executive branch should not have the authority to also regulate itself. That is the legislature's job. In speaking with the governor, I will tell you, this is a very bipartisan initiative. Senator Cronin is the author in the Senate. We are not moving any faster than the Senate is moving on this bill. This is the third, I believe, third committee hearing on this bill. You know, whatever, whenever this is taken up, I'm not sure. Certainly, I mean, there's been at least a week, as far as I know, in between committee hearings. So I don't believe that this is moving any quicker than any other piece of legislation that I've seen. And again, I think part of the reason that it can move maybe a little more fluidly than other bills is because this is the same language without changing anything that this body overwhelmingly supported last year. So, again, I don't think that this is confrontational. I think that if it was right for us to stand up for our for the legislative body, for this institution, last year, that we should have those same thoughts, feelings, and expectations as we move into this session. And compromise is both sides being willing and agreeing to meet somewhere other than where they're currently at. And the only compromise language I've seen from the lottery is, well, okay, we'll just agree to come to you in the future. And just let us keep doing what we're doing. And again, that's asking for forgiveness, and that's not compromising anything that they are currently doing, which we believe is stepping outside of their constitutional and statutory authority.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Sanders, you really didn't answer my question, which is what kind of attempts at compromise have you had with the governor? Because I know that he does feel rather strongly about this issue. Now, his opinion might be different than mine, and whether the legislature can kind of jam it down his throat doesn't mean that we should, because there are bigger fish to fry in this session. There are more important things, I would say, for the entire state to grapple with that are important to lots of citizens, and the relationship with the governor is going to be very important going forward. I think that you would have probably agree with that. And yet on this issue that's moving very early, I see that this is kind of moving in the direction of wanting to just put it on his desk, have him veto it again, and then possibly go to try to have a veto override. And to me, that doesn't set up the right kind of relationship going forward for the rest of the session. So I really would like to hear that you've sat down with the governor, that you've made a good faith attempt at compromise, and I think that we could protect the legislature's purview and still be saying, you know, this, yes, the lottery overstepped its bounds, but we can find common ground here and we can go forward and we can agree that that would be okay this time, recognizing that we're not giving up that authority, but compromise being what it is, we can do better than this, and I hope that you will. Thank you.
Representative Kahn, I should probably have gone back to you after Mr. Rice testified. I'm sorry I didn't do that. So please go ahead now.
Well, slightly. This is the issue of gubernatorial vetoes, and I didn't look at my past votes on this. Since I usually vote against expansion of gambling, I probably was part of that one. But the issue of overriding a governor's veto is very different. I have never voted to override the veto of a Democratic governor, and I don't know if you've and I don't know if you've ever voted to override the veto of a Republican governor. The history of the state, there are very okay. I wasn't asking you, Representative Hamilton. The history of the state is that there have been very few overrides, and most of them, I think, there have been maybe 12 overrides, and 9 of them occurred during Governor Ventura's administration. So, to my mind, once we're dealing with the override of a governor's veto, the issue becomes different. You know, we're then dealing with the issue of separation of powers and so forth, and the issue then becomes very different. And, you know, funding the whole transportation of the system of the state is a little bit different than this issue. And you need Democratic votes to override the governor's veto. And so that's kind of where I would like the discussion to be going. What can avoid this unnecessary conflict, where I might, on the subject, be on your side, but on the issue of supporting a Democratic governor, just not.
Well, I do have to comment, Representative Kahn. It's my memory that there was bipartisan agreement on overriding Governor Ventura's vetoes.
Yes.
But Representative
Sanders. I said that, but Governor Ventura was Democratic or a Republican.
All right. Representative Sanders.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's Representative Kahn and Representative Liebling. I mean, we are getting like four moves beyond where we're at right now,
okay.
And hopefully we never have to get to that point. Hopefully, like you said, if you're on my side of this subject matter, that you will urge the governor to sign the bill if it gets to his desk and say that, look, the lottery did step outside of their authority, and their compromise language, I believe, admits as such. That, hey, okay, from now on in the future, we'll come to you, but just let us keep doing what we're doing now. And so I would say that it's up to the governor. I had a 45-minute conversation with him in his residence with Senator Coonan. It was a very good conversation. I left that meeting telling him that my door is always open, would be happy to talk with him, and I'm always open to legitimate compromise language if we can get there. And as I said in the beginning, I think all this has to stop. The lottery could stop this. And just say, hey, we're going to stop what we're doing and come to the legislature and ask for permission. That could stop this. So this doesn't have to even get to the governor's desk. And the governor also can agree that the Constitution, the separation of powers issue, is one worth protecting and standing up for, regardless of who is governor or who has control of the legislature. And I'll also say that it is impossible for this bill to get to the governor's desk without extreme bipartisan support. Again, Senator Coonan in the Senate, controlled by the DFL. In order for this bill or any bill to get to the governor's desk, we have to have strong bipartisan support.
Well,
all right, Rob. Last question, Representative Kahn.
No, one comment on influence with the governor. I think I'm the only member, certainly of this current legislature, who has had the governor veto line items in a bill of mine after an agreement had been reached not to do it. So my level of ability to influence the governor is obviously below zero. So,
all right, Representative Garofalo, then Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Liebling, Representative Kahn, Representative Sanders, I come bearing good news. Just this weekend when I was reading the newspaper, I saw some quotes attributed to Governor Dayton where he has offered to back down from his repeated veto threats on this issue in response to some unrelated executive compensation issue that's going on in the Senate. And Mr. Chairman, that's in the Star Tribune, and if I read it in the Star Tribune, I know it's true. So I would say for those who are guaranteeing the governor's veto, I'd remind members of the opposite party that when Governor Pawlenty was that governor, we were not supposed to use that word. He had that word. It was locked up in a box with a key that only he had the actions to. But right now, we're seeing the governor is already signaling that he may actually consider signing this. So, Representative Sanders, I want to thank you for bringing the governor to the table, for moving forward on this. And I think I'm confident that once we pass this legislation, the governor is going to sign it into law.
Representative Hamilton, do you have any words of wisdom on gubernatorial vetoes?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to say, in light of the latest controversy, I'll be holding classes on how to survive a veto override. So if anybody would like to attend.
All right. Representative Winchesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sanders, as the author this year, you probably know I was the author last year. So it's interesting to listen to everybody talk about this bill. This was my bill last year. Chair Atkins at the time folded it into a bigger bill, but this is a bill I carried, and so I support this legislation. I will, however, say, I want to underline to you, I hope you will talk to the governor again. I think if people were listening to Representative Kahn, 12 veto overrides in the history of the state, 9 being for Governor Ventura, and Mr. Chair, you and I were there, and of course the two political parties were overriding a governor who was not in their party. So that's three. That's just three. And as somebody who was the author of the bill, I understand the bill, but You know, I too think overrides of governors should not be taken lightly. Representative Hamilton has pointed out that he is one of the people who voted for one of those three. And there were huge repercussions for that for many years, not just for that in those individual legislators, but for many years. And so, you know, Representative Sanders, I guess I would just ask you, I do support the bill, but I would ask you if you'd be willing to talk to the governor yet again before you get to the floor.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lenchesky. Yes, always. Always happy to talk with, regardless of the bill that I'm carrying, with the other side, understand where they're coming from and see if we can reach agreement. I think that has been my track record and hopefully reputation in this body with I've been able to get bills signed in every session I've been here. It's I think every session I've been here, there's been a flip-flop and majority-minority, Republican governor, Democratic governor, still able to get things done. So I don't think I've ever said the word veto with this bill. I hope that he signs it. And hopefully we can avoid going down that road. That is such a serious thing to get to that point. Hopefully we don't have to get there. And if there was, for some reason, movement to get to that point, I mean, it would obviously have to be something that the chamber was willing to do in standing up for the institution of the House. So I think we're so far away from that being happening. I hope it doesn't. I hope the governor will sign the legislation and certainly willing, just to repeat, to have any conversations with him or others on serious compromise.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just very briefly, I know in Masons you cannot use potential actions of a governor in your deliberations. That's on the floor. Do our committee rules allow such talk?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
Just a correction. There is nothing. We continually listen to what the executive wants. The governor's commissioners continually do. Masons only referring to actions of the opposite chamber, which I've had, actually, the author has done a couple of times, but I decided not to antagonize him by calling to a point of order. But there's nothing in Masons, and I would, you know, we can compare our additions when we get on the floor. There's nothing in Masons that says you're not supposed to refer to the actions of the executive.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Davids.
I'll be doing a little more research on that, and I will bring that over to my seatmate, Representative Kahn.
Okay. I do have one other person that wanted to testify, if we have time. But Representative Drazkowski, do you have a point?
I did. Just quickly, Mr. Chair, thank you for hearing this bill today. Thank you, Representative Sanders. Just an observation, members, this is an oversight function that we as a legislature are committed to do, and we're required to do this. As a matter of fact, I've seen, and we saw last week, where another agency, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, acted without authority in law to do something as well. It acted to institute a fee for a program it had no legislative authority to do. So, Mr. Chair, bringing these types of issues before this body, I think, is important. There's more opportunities to do it, and it's our job to do so. So thank you, Representative Sanders.
Okay, members, is Mr. Jake Grassel in the audience? I know he had also requested to testify, and I want to give him the opportunity since I think we've got a few minutes here. Mr. Grassel, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Chairman Knobloch. I did sign up to testify, but I think the testimony that's been before this committee and the other policy committees has been sufficient. I'll leave it at that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Grassel.
Good answer.
Any other questions for the author? Representative Murphy? I'm sorry, the man who just testified? Jake Grassel.
Representing.
He's with the Citizens Against Gambling Expansion. Thank you for mentioning that. Since he didn't really testify, I wasn't sure if we needed to get into that, but that's fine. He's with the Citizens Against Gambling Expansion Organization. All right, seeing no further questions, the chair will renew his motion that House File 374 be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 374 is referred to the General Register. The meeting is adjourned.